All right. Hello, my name is Magali, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Magali.
Hi. Welcome to Wacky Paw 15 in Las Vegas. Wacky Paw is the Western Area Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Please help me open this meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The topic of this panel meeting is Proud to Be Me, and I have asked Kayla to read a passage from AA literature related to the topic or of her choice. Kayla?
I'll tell this down, I'm short. Kayla, alcoholic.
Hi, Kayla.
Hi. I'm on page 87, and it says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. Do I share?
Yeah.
Okay. Kayla, alcoholic again. I read this every single day. It helps me just my first month of sobriety today. And I just know. Yay. Knowing and, like, willing to be able to turn my life over into, like, my higher power has helped me a lot, because when I do pause each day, when I'm, like, pissed off or something, I know, like, I have faith in my higher power that he can help me get through every day, and I know that I can't run this show anymore, and, like, coming to my first convention and seeing everyone else, too, it's a really big blessing in my life to have you guys here and seeing everyone go through some similar things that I have, and that's all I got.
Thanks, Kayla. All right, now I would like to welcome our first speaker, Michael B. from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Michael.
Evening, everyone. I'm Michael. I'm an alcoholic. And technically, I'm not from Las Vegas. I moved here on a slight geographical location move about 10 years ago from the UK, from Wales. And I've been sober for about 3.5 years. So up until that, my move to Las Vegas, my drinking was pretty consistent all the way through high school and through my teenage years. And it's pretty common in my culture. Where I'm from, it's pretty common to give kids alcohol. And it's very... everyone around me was alcoholic, so I didn't realize I had a problem until I moved to the U.S., and then everyone kind of pointed out that I had a problem with it because I couldn't stop, and I kept getting into crazy situations and on a super, super self-destructive mode. So it was only after many, many, many interventions by my partner and by friends and stuff to try and get me sober. I think the last one was... I was kind of cut off from going anywhere. My partner would hide the car keys from me, and I would only just go to the little local bar on the corner because that's where I could kind of walk to and get home from. So it was the nighttime cook there would talk to me. He would come over and speak to me and just like, you know, you're not doing so good. And he would kind of tell me his story over a period of months and months and months. And little by little, I kind of got the message of Alcoholics Anonymous through this guy who was sober, working in a bar. And I went there one night, and I just couldn't get drunk enough, and I couldn't stand myself anymore. And I just that at that point, I was like, okay, this is it. I'm going to rehab tomorrow. And they're like, yeah, I can imagine that. And I did. I went to rehab the next day and signed myself in. And that was the beginning of my journey into sobriety. The first month of rehab was probably the most terrifying experience of my life. I pretty much used alcohol from the age of 3. It was the first time I was drunk at my uncle's wedding. I was going around all the tables drinking from everybody's drink, and I just remember how, I remember feeling like the room was bright. Like, I'm a little kid, and I just remember feeling the room was bright, and I was okay. And I felt okay in my skin, and I just passed out under the table. And everyone thought it was cute, and it was fun and stuff. And, you know, it just, every family occasion from that point, or there was always an opportunity for me to drink where when I needed to, pretty much. So I just carried on doing that for such a long time. It was always my solution. So getting sober, going through rehab, was the most terrifying experience of my life, because I just, everything I'd suppressed all my life started coming out. All of the feelings, all the memories, everything. I come from an alcoholic family. My mother was an alcoholic and a drug addict when I was a little boy. I was growing up in the UK where, you know, I may sound like I'm educated, but I come from kind of like the projects in the UK. Where I lived in, it's a kind of like a council estate. It was government property. And kind of fended for myself for the first few years of my life, the very early years of my life. So it was very, it was kind of very tough growing up. And I learned to just suppress my feelings and just kind of go through life numb. And high school kind of was the turning point when I started kind of, you know, coming out and realizing that I'm gay and coming to terms with my sexuality. And that's when it kind of accelerated, and I started to, but I also, as my alcoholism kind of developed, there was also this like self-love that developed as well. So I don't know how that kind of coexisted at the same time, but I was really confident in who I was. I told my mother I was gay. My mother read my diary when I was like 15, and I had a crush on my school teacher, and she like threw it on the table watching TV one night. She's like, "So are you?" And I was like, for a split second, I'm just like, you know, if I don't tell her now, I'm never going to tell her. So I'm like, yeah, I am. I think I am. And she didn't talk to me for a while. She told everyone in the town that I was gay. So all of my friends, by the next day I went into school, everybody knew I was gay. I was like outed overnight. I'm from like a little coal mining town in the valleys. Like, you can imagine how it was. It was at the turn, you know, I'm 35 years old. It was at the point when AIDS was breaking in the UK. So up until that point, like, we were tolerated, and actually, you know, gays and lesbians were pretty much, you know, the norm. But at that point, once AIDS broke, it just went crazy and everyone hated us. So there was a lot of homophobia, and a lot of, you know, everyone kind of turned against me. My mother didn't talk to me for a long time. I remember just my escape was going to the clubs in the city when I was like 16 years old. I lived on the top of the mountain, and I would hear the train coming around the valley, and I would run. I knew it would take me a certain amount of time to get from the point where I would hear the train running to run down the hill, so I wouldn't have to stop, and I wouldn't have to hear the abuse, or I wouldn't have to look at anyone. So I could just jump on the train, get to the city, and just mix with everyone. And I knew I was safe in the city. I could just be anonymous there. And you know, that kind of saved me. Once I went to my first gay club, I remember walking in and just looking around, and I can remember it clearly to this day, just identifying with so many people in there. You know, up until that point, there wasn't much, you know, we don't have really good role, well, when I was a kid, there weren't that many good role models on TV and stuff, you know. It was always kind of, we were comical, we were to be laughed at or making fun of and stuff. So to go into a club and seeing people that were just regular, normal human beings, but just with a different sexual preference was amazing to me. And, you know, there was so much relief, and, you know, I loved it. And I found a network of friends, and I got very social, and I got very active in the gay community, and I just became really proud with who I was. You know, and then moved away from home, got away from that environment, and just spent a lot of my time traveling around Europe, and I went to university and studied hotel management, and that's how I ended up coming over to the U.S. But all the time, my kind of drinking career is still going on. You know, I still have to have that, but I don't really know that that's a problem yet. When I was 21 years old, I got diagnosed that I was HIV positive. That was kind of the point where I really kind of just self-destructed. That's when I just went completely downhill. I just got lost in drinking like all the time. And then one of my aunts sent me on vacation to the US, to Las Vegas. And while I was here, I met a guy, my ex, who we were together for about 12 years. And I kind of got sober in that relationship, but, you know, it was just at that point I realized that I was just running away from whatever was going on inside of me, and I didn't want to face anything, so I just thought, well, I can leave my family over there. I'll go and start a new life over here, and it'll all be good. I'll be able to be the person that I want to be. But, you know, slowly it kind of creeps up, and, you know, I'm this little guy out here on my own, and everything catches up to me, and my life just kind of carries on going unmanageable. But so I'm just kind of rambling. So we'll go back to where I came out of, went to rehab and came out, and it starts getting good. Okay. So I go to rehab. It's the most horrific experience of my life. I start remembering everything. You know, I'm in a rehab with five guys who are, they're all straight. They're all convinced, even though they didn't know, they were all convinced I had AIDS. They wouldn't let me touch the food. It was like this, it was drama every fucking day. It was like from waking to sleeping. And I now know that's just recovery. You know, everyone's raw, and that's what we're like when we're new to it. But, you know, I came out of rehab, and one of the guys working there introduced me to somebody who he suggested. He's like, you know, I know this guy. I'll be really good for you. You kind of remind me of him. So the first day I came out of rehab, I went to a meeting, and I met this guy who eventually became my sponsor. You know, he introduced me, and he took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's when my life started to get kind of really, really good, because I could connect with him. You know, even though I was terrified, I would still call him. I gradually let my guard down and, you know, started to open up more and more and more. And I'd say after doing my step five with him, that was the point in my life where I experienced, as I was driving away from his house, I'm going down the road, and I was looking at the road, and I could see the road. And, like, my world is so literal. Like, my world shows me stuff that I meant to see, really, kind of. So I could see the road, and I'm like, I can see the road. I've never seen the road. I've never seen what's in front of me so close and so cleanly, because I've always been covered in all this emotional crap that I've been carrying around all my life. So after doing that, it was just, you know, showing up for life was a lot easier. When I didn't have all the baggage carrying around and all that stuff, I can show up for my life, and it's so much more, it's just effortless now. You know, today I still am active in AA. I go to meetings 5 days a week, 6 days a week. I talk to my sponsor all the time, and I'm not immune to causing drama and getting myself into situations. You know, that still happens. But I have a solution today. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a choice. Before, I didn't have a choice. I was just drinking, that was it, or using other substances. That's how I learned how to change how I felt. I didn't know that, you know, being honest with another human being, turning myself over to my higher power, I didn't know that before. So, you know, I'm grateful for AA for giving me the choices that I have today. And you know, yeah, like I said, I set the firing curtain. I set the curtains on fire some days, but you know, I can sleep at night today. And anyway, I don't know what else to. Is that good? So, anybody have any questions? I'll let you kind of ask me. If... No? Okay. Cool.
Okay, so our next speaker is on her way, so I'm going to need a volunteer till she gets here. Who would like to come up and share? Come on up. Yeah. You. You know? You come up here and you talk about proud to be me.
Proud to be me? Oh, crap. Okay. Hello, my name is Brian. I'm an addict and alcoholic.
Hi, Brian.
Is this on? Glad to be here. The topic of this panel is proud to be me. All right, cool. I guess a little about me. I grew up in New York. I live in New York. I got sober June 28th, 2004, after a couple of failed attempts at trying to get this program. I tried in 2003, and I tried in 2002. And when I came in 2004... I think I was able to look back at all the stuff that I didn't do. There was this awesome checklist of all the things I didn't do when I tried to get sober the first time. And they included going to 90 meetings in 90 days, getting a sponsor that I didn't live to defy, working the steps, getting a home group, and doing service. It was, I don't know, it was kind of a rocky time in recovery my first year. Do you mind if I hold on to the microphone? Is that okay? All right, cool. Can you hear me? All right, cool. I'm not so sure. I don't know how to really, I can't really hear myself, but I don't know. I think, okay, so one of the things that kept me drinking and one of the things that kept me using for a really long time was shame. I spent the good part of my recovery, not my recovery, I spent a good part of my using, especially the winter months, in a bathrobe in my backyard in Brooklyn. I would drink 40 ounces of beer or smoke, you know, cheap dime bags of pot in my backyard out of homemade Coke bottle bongs. And, you know, I wouldn't leave my house until the sun went down. Like, I would, I remember the way the sun looked at around 4 o'clock in the afternoon coming through the windows of my bedroom. I very distinctly remember knowing that that was when, that it was almost time for me to, go out and do whatever it was that I needed to do. And I never really needed to do much of anything because when I was using, I didn't really have much of a life. But, you know, when I did come in, I had to and thank God for the steps, you know, with the help of the steps, I had to really sort of disentangle a lot of what had gone on in my using life. There was a lot of crazy sexual behavior. There was a lot of unaccountability. There was a whole lot of me just not showing up for my life and being selfish and completely self-seeking and, you know, I was basically a vacuum when I was using. And, you know, thanks to recovery and thanks to one day at a time not picking up a drink or a drug, I learned to turn a lot of that around. Part of my bottom was flunking out of school. You know, part of my bottom was I went to Boston University for a year and a half and made an ass of myself on a daily basis. Like, I left a very homophobic home in Brooklyn. It was actually very similar to the upbringing that you had. It was kind of rough. And my mother sort of did the same thing where she dumped a garbage bag full of journals and writings and, you know, love letters that I never sent to teachers and to students, just shit like that. I'm a writer in life, so that was kind of where I got my start, which is fucked up. But I very distinctly remember that, and it was just, you know, I had to disentangle a lot of that. I had to disentangle a lot of the, you know, the homophobic upbringing sort of propelled me to go to Boston and do this thing where I was in a different city and that I would completely reinvent myself. That is my geographic. And I was completely ingenuine with the people that I knew up there. And I think that's part of the reason why I didn't make very many friends. And I think it's part of the reason why I didn't have the best time of it, because I think people knew that I just wasn't being real. And so when I got sober, I had to figure out who the hell I was. And I had to figure out that, you know what, it's okay to be more comfortable, to not really need to do gay nightlife. And it's okay to not need to, you know, be shaved, plucked, and moisturized all the fucking time. You know, it's okay to not be pretty. Like, I don't have to, like, I mean, you know, if my place is in mixed company, my place is in mixed company. Like, generally, I mean, I, you know, I'm a 90s kid, so the sort of approach was kind of come as you are. And I try my best to sort of live in that in recovery. And I, you know, thankfully, I've had plenty of opportunities to amend the behavior that kept me using, to amend the behavior that kept me living in the shame cycle of, you know, having publicly humiliated myself, having failed out of school, having you know, publicly humiliated myself professionally. And, you know, I've got 7.5 years sober and a little bit of change. And I think in the time that I've been sober, I've had a lot of opportunities to go after what I want in life and to, I guess, make some very concerted efforts to do things differently. I have a lot of point of references, you know, and points of reference, you know, from my using that have sort of helped me do things differently today. In recovery, I went back to school, which was a big one. And I had to go back to school with the 1.7 GPA that I had from BU and to sort of explain myself. And I did that. And I just graduated this past spring. I graduated summa cum laude with the plaque and the check for $5,000 from my school. It's like, thank you. I mean, like, that's one of those things. It's not like, yeah, but no. It's really more about, like, I was the fuck up. Like, I was the kid that was like, whoa. You know, like, me then and me now, it's just, I mean, like, I have become a completely different person thanks to the guidelines, suggestions, and the program of action that Alcoholics Anonymous has laid out for me. You know, I haven't done things perfectly. You know, my sexual behavior has sort of wavered in and out of this, you know, haze of being healthy and then being unhealthy and then being completely out of control and then, you know, like not really happening at all. And I think I've found some balance in my life today as a result of addressing my character defects and, you know, really sort of letting God guide me through those areas of my life. And it feels a lot better to sort of feel like I'm operating with, you know, God's will in mind and not mine. That's a big one. That's a really big one. I feel like we don't have to, in general, as sober alcoholics, if we live out each of our days, a day at a time, asking God what his will is for us and acting in accordance with that, then generally we don't have to dodge people. We don't have to lie. We don't have to keep that sort of catalog of lies that we, you know, keeps like, what did I tell this person or, you know, there. It's like our integrity gets to sort of become more and more complete as we stay sober because we're, you know, trying to act in accordance with God's will. And, you know, whatever that means to you. My higher power for like a year and a half in recovery was Catwoman, because as played by Michelle Pfeiffer, because when I had my moment of clarity, that's whose voice I heard on a rooftop on 8th Street in the Village at the Gay Pride Parade. You know, that's kind of, I mean, and I haven't done that perfectly. None of us are going to do this program perfectly, but I think that that's the simplest way to be proud of who you are, you know, is to work harder and harder at being true to your higher power's will, being true to yourself, going after what you want in a way that isn't, you know, I guess, I don't know how to say this. I mean, like, I whenever I talk about what I've done in recovery, I don't want to sound like I've been through a battering ram, sort of like breaking down doors to get what I want, but I've made an honest effort at whatever it is that I've done to sort of enrich my life, to sort of build my life in recovery. And, you know, I think Principles Before Personalities is a tool that has definitely helped me in those endeavors. And, you know, the bottom line is today, like, I can look at what I've done in recovery when I was using and look back on everything, good or bad, with pride and not with shame, with a degree of compassion, too, and not, you know, too much criticism. I heard when I had about like a year and a half into recovery, and I'll wrap up with this because I understand our speaker's here. Hello. A year and a half in recovery, I had been on this course where I was just really kicking the shit out of myself for everything. If I said the wrong thing, if I tripped, if my pants were tighter than I thought they were when I left the house and I figured that out on the train and it was too late to change, like I would just be really harsh on myself. And I heard somebody else in a meeting share that, you know, she was visiting New York and she was remembering what she was like and that she was lost when she was using and that she was sick when she was using. And I lost it because I had not been able to think of myself with that much compassion. Without letting myself off the hook, I had to learn to think of myself and to think of, you know, what it was like with a degree of compassion for the fact that I was a sick and suffering alcoholic without a program, without a higher power, and without a fellowship. We're blessed with that today. I'm blessed with that today, and I'm really grateful for it. And, you know, I'm grateful to honor that, and I'm grateful to say that I'm pretty proud of how far I've come, but not necessarily because of all the cash and the prizes or professional this or that, but because I've managed to stay sober. I've managed to sort of do my best to take every day as it comes with, you know, my higher power in mind, and I've stayed, you know. So if you're here, you know, if you're new, stay. This program is, I mean, it's pretty miraculous. We're all miracles today, so thank you. Is this my Red Bull?
Yes. Thank you so much. Okay, our next speaker is Lacey. Lacey?
Hi, I'm Lacey. I'm an alcoholic. Lesbian alcoholic. I mean, I guess that's what we're supposed to talk about. When I first got sober, I didn't think I really had a problem because everything was a problem and that was manageable for me. And I really like what the last guy said because I've been sober now for almost 10 years. And that's hard for an alcoholic, but I think it's even harder for somebody who's gay because you have the issues of alcoholism and then you have the issues of not being accepted. And I now am just barely starting to touch on self-love and realizing all of the stuff that I did while I was using and drinking that was abusive to myself. I grew up in a really small Mormon town, so I was Mormon, or raised Mormon, and I would always drink so that I could try to make out with girls, and then I did drugs because I loved drugs, and ended up doing things with anybody just because, actually, and so I remember I was working with a sponsor once, and I was saying, well, it wasn't really that bad because I wasn't ever, like, a prostitute or anything like that. And she told me that that's because you didn't charge for it, you know? And I was like, yeah, I guess. Dang. But I don't know. There's, like, a lot of those things, you know, because I was like, well, I was never homeless. And when you're sleeping on somebody else's couch that's not your own, that you didn't pay for, then you're homeless, whether you're outside or not. So I was like, yeah, I guess I was homeless and a non-paid hooker. And it just, like, made me feel like shit. And then I didn't have anything to make myself feel better. When I first got sober, I think it's kind of funny. I had to have a co-signer for a cell phone. Like, that's how fucked up shit got for me. And I would switch different types of drugs. Like, I would only drink for a while, and then I would only do meth for a while, and then I would only do natural drugs. And when I decided to go on the natural drugs, I thought it would, like, make my life better. I actually did a geographical, and I moved to Tucson. And I ended up meeting this guy named White Dog that had dreadlocks, like, that went down to the ground. And I swear he was, like, 80, but he was probably, like, 50 or something. I don't know. He was old. And I was, like, 19. And I ended up finding every natural drug I could get my hands on. So I was doing mushrooms, toad, opium, hash, hemp milk. Like, I mean, it was just like, it just got really crazy really fast. And it was like, no matter where I went, I could always find everything. And it wasn't long before I thought I was Jesus Christ in a woman's body. And my family thought I was schizophrenic, and they decided they were going to do an intervention on me. And I thought everything was perfect. Like, I was like, oh, I'm helping God's kids, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I was actually getting brainwashed and I was like this close to being put into a cult or putting myself into a cult but didn't know it. Like, I didn't think it was a big deal that they were trying to change my name. I just thought that's what I was like, oh, cool, I get to have a new name. You know, like, little did I know they were, like, going to take me to their plantation, you know, like. And this is another crazy thing is, I know none of this is crazy, but they were telling, this guy, White Dog, was trying to tell me that part of my job as being a woman and a female was to sleep with any man that wants to be with me. And I started to believe it. And luckily, my family had their intervention before I slept with too many guys. But so they convinced me to come and visit with them. And in the night, they went back down to Tucson and grabbed all my stuff and moved me up back up to Little Mormon country. And I saw all of my friends and all of my family, and they all thought I was crazy. And I thought they were crazy. Because I could fly, and I was Jesus Christ in a woman's body. And I just remember that night, I was questioning God, and I just said, you know, like, what the fuck? I've been doing everything you want me to do, and why is everything like this? And all of a sudden, a car drove by. Oh, I was walking barefoot, too. I was walking barefoot wearing a sarong. With nothing under it. And I was vegetarian at the time, of course, because that's just what you do when you're getting ready to change your name and join a cult. So I was like 90 pounds and walking down the road in a purple sarong, barefoot, and a car drove by and said, get the fuck out of the road. So I was like, fuck you. I wasn't even in the road. So I started walking in the road, and all of a sudden, I was suicidal. I wasn't, but because I was walking in the road, it appeared that I was suicidal. So the town cop pulled over in front of me and was like a hero trying to save me from committing suicide, which I wasn't trying to commit suicide. I just couldn't fly at the time. And so I jumped over the cop car. Or jumped on top of the cop car, broke the back windshield, and kept on running, and ended up injuring the police officer. Because I was fighting to get away, fighting for my life, is what I thought. And so they shot me up full of drugs, and I ended up in behavioral meds center. And it took, like, a couple days for everything to wear off, to where I didn't think I could fly anymore, and I didn't think I was Jesus Christ in a woman's body anymore, and I started to feel like myself again. But you know that saying, like, what goes up must come down? I came down that hard. I was very, very, very depressed and lost, and in $30,000 worth of debt from medical bills, you know, all the schizophrenic tests and everything. And then right after that, I got thrown in jail for injuring a police officer when I didn't even know that I had done that. And I still didn't think I had a problem. I just needed to stay away from natural drugs. And so it took a lot of work to try to get everything back, because my family thought I was crazy. My friends thought I was crazy. And all of a sudden, I was back to myself, but nothing was like it was. Everything